Barrett sharing with us one morning, and he talked about how some college students or youth group students had started doing bingo cards for him, where they would, you know, they would have like a card of things he might say or do during the sermon, and they would see who could complete their card. And this morning, literally, as I was sitting down, as worship was about to start, I saw my wife. She was opening up her phone because she had gotten a text, and I just happened to see she got a picture sent to her from someone, and it said, Jeremy's bingo card. So I don't know who all is playing out there. Best of luck to you, but I'm rooting for my wife this morning. You know, one fascinating thing about being at Southside on any given Sunday morning is the variety of places we are in life. You know, there are so many different seasons of life represented here any given week. So we have people who are in the season of a new marriage, and we have people who have been married for over 50 years. We have those who are in the middle of a busy time with their career, or they're busy with caring for a newborn. Some people are doing both, right? And we have college students and high schoolers, middle schoolers, children, all in different seasons of life. I really am thankful for that. I think it's wonderful. You know, we have different things going on, valuable perspectives we can bless each other with. And I do hope you think of it that way, that your season is not just something you're going through, but it's also something that can bless someone else for the glory of God. Now, if you have spent much time around children, you know a child's season of life changes quickly, so quickly. From moment to moment and year to year, it feels like there's always a new thing. I have a 2-year-old niece right now. She recently discovered she can say no to things, okay? Guess what her answer to your question is? It's no. Everything is no right now. They are very much in the season of no. Now, my family is made up of myself, my wife, and our 7-year-old son. And a season we're currently in, well, okay, actually, we've recently been a season of balloon animals because he got really into balloon animals over Christmas. So our house was full of balloon creatures. If you need like a balloon dog or a balloon sword, just let us know. But another season we've been in is a season of fairness, okay, a season of fairness. So we have been considering what is and isn't fair. And honestly, mostly we're honing in on what isn't fair, okay? So for example, it's not fair that an adult gets to pick how big their brownie is, and a kid has to just get the brownie given to them. It's not fair when it's snowing somewhere else and not snowing here. And of course, a big one, it's not fair that adults can stay up later, right? That's not fair. And I get it. I really get it. I remember thinking about those things. I always thought it wasn't fair that I had a summer birthday, and so I didn't get to celebrate my birthday at school like all the other kids did, you know, when a parent brings in cupcakes or something for the class. That wasn't fair. And as I've thought more about it, I've realized that wrestling with fairness and unfairness is not just a kid thing. We do it, all of us, all the time. Maybe you purchase something only for it to go on sale the next day. It doesn't feel fair, right? Maybe you were a firstborn child, and you got to watch your younger sibling not have to follow all the rules that you were given growing up. Doesn't feel very fair. Maybe you got in trouble for something at work that other people have done without getting called out for it. That's not fair. And every day, from moment to moment, for most of our lives, we've had to contend with situations that may not seem very fair. And I don't know, maybe as adults, we've lived it for so long that it's become normal for us. So we don't really blink, you know, when things go well for one person and poorly for another. But a child looks at the world and instinctively expects justice, fairness. And when one person gets and another goes without, or one person is allowed and another denied, they call it out. They say, that's not fair. And what do you say to that? What would you say? What have you said? Maybe you say what millions of adults have said to children throughout history. Might be what your parents said to you, or what I've admittedly said to my son. They say, that's not fair, and you say what? Ah, well, life's not fair. Got 'em, right? Life's not fair. Who's right? I mean, which perspective there is better? Is it the adult quoting life's not fair? Or is the truth that they're just jaded? They've faced unfairness so many times they've given up being bothered by it. Or is the better perspective the young person, fist raised against the world saying that's not fair? Or is the truth that they're young and immature and naive. They just don't understand the way the world works. What do we do? What do we do when life's not fair? Well, today we're in Psalm 37, as Dan read for us earlier. And this is a psalm that will help us consider fairness and our response to it. Now, we're a little out of order, admittedly, because of the Sunday we missed the snow. So I think Barrett's going to catch us up with Psalm 36 next week. But today we're in Psalm 37, and it's an instructional psalm. It's in the genre of wisdom literature. So in some ways, this psalm is going to read more like a proverb, more like wisdom advice than a song of praise. You know, wisdom literature, it concerns itself with how you should live your life. Are you living in a way that leads to wisdom or foolishness? Righteousness or wickedness? Life or death? And in the first verse, David lays out the issue for our consideration. He says, "Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers." Now, these are the words of David, the king of Israel. This is how he begins this psalm. And the first thing he does is lay out a very specific unfairness. It's an injustice that would make a child say it. That's not fair. It is the unfairness of the prosperous evildoer. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers. Fret not. That phrase there, if you work it out literally, it comes across stronger in the Hebrew. It's actually, do not let your anger burn. The idea is not to allow your anger to overwhelm you, to control you. Do not let your anger burn because of evildoers. Do not envy them. And just this one verse, it encapsulates the issue at stake here. The key unfairness of this psalm is this. You are going to encounter people who lie and cheat, who manipulate and intimidate, who abuse and hurt others, and sometimes they will come out ahead because of it. In verse 7, we see the same phrase repeated, that fret not, that do not let your anger burn. And then David pinpoints the issue. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way over the man who carries out evil devices. See, it's not just the evil itself that's so frustrating, that makes our anger burn, that makes our blood boil. It's when the evil person wins. When their evil actions that come at the cost of others help them get ahead, and they never pay a price for what they've done. I don't know if you had a bully or bullies when you were younger. And I'm aware, too, that you can have a bully or be a bully, really, at any age, not just as a young person. But I had a bully in high school, and look, I don't want to paint myself as some perfect innocent in high school. There may have been people who thought of me as a bully back then, but if they did, it was not because I had, like, the physique to pick on them, okay? I remember weighing, like, 90 pounds and looking at a classmate of mine who weighed 180 and had a full beard, right? That's not fair, okay? But my bully, he was bigger. You know, he was a big, tall guy. And honestly, I don't know how or why it got started, why he picked me, but he did. And he would just say mean things about me and make sure it got back to me, make sure I heard about it. But the thing that bothered me the most was he started telling people he wanted to fight me. He wanted to beat me up. And it really kind of got to me, you know. I'd be in the cafeteria, and I would look over and just see him staring at me across the room, and we'd meet eyes, and he'd smile, and he'd laugh, and he'd get his friends in, and they'd point and laugh at me. And I remember lying in my bed at night, just like wondering what I was going to do. You know, how am I going to survive this fight? I'm running the scenario through my head over and over again, trying to stop thinking about it, and just wondering why. You know, why did he pick me? And then nothing ever happened. Nothing happened ever. You know, I think he just sort of forgot about it. He moved on, and I don't know if he even cared about it at all. Maybe it was just a big joke to him. But to be honest, it kind of tore me up there for a while, you know. I was scared to go to school. I was really scared. I don't know if he ever faced any sort of consequences for that. And I get that's really small. It's really, really small in the whole scheme of things. Life's not fair after all. But it speaks to the mundane, the everyday, very true reality that David writes about, that we may suffer at the hands of our fellow humans while they face no consequences or they even benefit from their evil. And it can be much worse, much more serious than my, high school bully. And in times like that, neither answer, either yelling, "That's not fair," or being told, "Life's not fair," neither answer really seems sufficient. But David, in Psalm 37, he does more than just identify the problem. He seeks to give us a way forward when we see the wicked prosper. So we'll take this morning our cues from the first three verses largely. Much of Psalm 37 goes on to elaborate further on the main ideas of these three verses. So let's read them all together here. "Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness." David first gives us the what. He lays out the issue: to not fret, to not let your anger burn. Don't be overtaken by your anger when you see this going on. And then David next tells us why. Because the wicked will soon fade like the grass, they will wither like an herb. See, David says our perspective, our view, can be wrong. While it seems like someone may be prospering through their unethical ways without ever facing consequences, the truth is that we just sometimes have too short a view. That any prosperity or benefits people seem to inherit from evil are fleeting and temporary. And he makes this point over and over in the psalm. Verse 9, "The evildoers shall be cut off." Verse 10, "The wicked will be no more." Verse 20, "The wicked will perish. Like smoke, they vanish away." See, while the grass may seem greener on the other side, the grass quickly withers and dies. In verse 35, David says this: "I've seen a wicked, ruthless man spreading himself like a green laurel tree." That, of course, we recognize. That's the problem, right? A man, a person can grow their reach, their wealth, and power through ruthless abuses. But David reminds us that's not the whole story. "But he passed away. Behold, he was no more. Though I sought him, he could not be found." It's actually remarkably similar to the parable Jesus will tell later in Luke 12, 13 through 21. As he warns the crowd against greed, Jesus recounts the parable about the rich man who has so much he can't store all his wealth. So he tears down the storehouses. He builds larger ones. He says to himself, "I've got everything I need now. I'll take life easy. I'll eat, drink, and be merry." And then that very night, his life ends. And the conclusion Jesus gives is this: "This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich toward God." Ill-gotten wealth is fleeting. It's fake. It doesn't last. And ultimately, we face God's justice. But David in Psalm 37, he takes it even a step further. Not only are the gains of the wicked fleeting and temporary, they are actually their own worst enemy. Look at verses 14 and 15 with me. "The wicked draw the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose way is upright. Their sword shall enter their own heart, and their bows shall be broken." You see, the tools of evil only bring about suffering and destruction. For others, yes, but also for those who wield them. There's a guy, Marcus Licinius Crassus. He was a Roman. He lived about 100 years before Jesus came onto the scene. He was actually like a contemporary and a political ally of both Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great. They had like this unofficial political alliance called the First Triumvirate. It allowed them to really dominate Roman politics for a time. And Crassus, listen, he fits the description of the wicked in Psalm 37. He's a man who built power and wealth on a foundation of cruelty and ruthlessness toward others. You know, at the time in Roman life, fires were a near daily occurrence in Rome. They were a real problem, and there was no fire department. And so Crassus created one. He created the first fire department, a brigade of 500 men. And at the first sign of a fire, his men would rush to the scene. There's the Roman citizens burning property. And they would get there and do nothing. They would sit and wait, watching it burn. And Crassus would roll in as this building burns, and he would offer to buy the property from the owner for a pathetic price. Now, if they sold, then Crassus' men would leap into action. They'd put out the fire on the property that now belonged to Crassus, and he was now a richer man. Sometimes he would even rent the property back to the person who had just been the owner moments before. And of course, if they didn't sell, it burned to the ground. He was ambitious as well, leaping at any opportunity to further his name. You have probably heard or may have heard of Spartacus's revolt, right? Well, Crassus, he's the real guy who ultimately crushed the slave rebellion. And they crucified some 6,000 captured slaves as a warning to others. But as his power and wealth and fame grew, he grew less and less satisfied, as if whatever he was chasing, the more he chased it, the less happy he got. You know, Julius Caesar and Pompey, they both had more impressive military victories to their name. Crassus couldn't live with it, so he set his sights on the Parthian Empire. Victory there would make him both famous and immensely wealthy. And his ambition led to disaster. He underestimated their cavalry and archers. They decimated his forces. His son was killed in the battle. And there, with his soldiers on the verge of mutiny, he had no choice but to try and negotiate some sort of peace agreement. But as they met, something went wrong. A fight broke out at the negotiation. Crassus and his men were all killed. Now, it's hard to verify, but there is this legend. There are these accounts that say that after Crassus was killed, the Parthians poured molten gold into his mouth, mocking his insatiable thirst for wealth and power. And that's how his story ended. The tools of evil and wickedness destroy the one who wields them. The message of Psalm 37 here is echoed in Jesus' words to Peter, when he tells him, put away your weapon, put away your violence, because what? Those who live by the sword will die by it. Or when he told his followers that a healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Now, sure, maybe not every end is as obvious as Crassus's, right? But the truth is evil robs you. It robs you of the full life God intended for you. It corrupts your relationships. It poisons your heart. It is its own punishment, with an ultimate punishment as its end. I heard David Skidmore, he's a minister down in Tennessee, describe it this way once. He said, sin is not so much about messing up as it is about missing out. See, sin carries its own price. If we return back to the beginning of Psalm 37, here we are. David has given us the what. Don't let your anger overwhelm you when the wicked prosper. He's given us the why, because their prosperity is fleeting and evil brings its own terrible consequences. And now finally in verse 3, he gives us the how. How do we respond then? Trust in the Lord, do good, dwell in the land, and befriend faithfulness. When we are confronted with injustice brought about by the evil of a fellow human, there is an inclination within us to repay evil with evil, to give someone a taste of their own medicine, hurt them like they hurt us. David understands, and that's why in verse 8 he writes, refrain from anger, forsake wrath, fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. He knows the allure of vengeance and the terrible cost it brings, so he points us in a different direction, to trust God, to do good, dwell in the land, sit with him, wait on the Lord, and befriend faithfulness. The Christian response to evil is not passive. It's never been passive. It's active. It's to trust. God is to do good, to befriend faithfulness, to think, consider, practice what it means to be faithful in the face of evil and unfairness and injustice. We have an active response, but no matter what, we do not abandon our virtue. We do not discard the fruits of the Spirit. We do not cast aside the character of God in our response to evil. Instead, we cling all the tighter to them. Our faithfulness is our response. You know, Paul will later echo David's words in Romans 12 when he tells us to live peaceably with all, repay no one evil for evil, never avenge yourselves, and overcome evil with good. There's been a lot of coverage on the news about the murder of the UnitedHealthcare CEO back in December. He was shot. He was killed in the street on his way to a conference. It was all over the media there. For a while, as they were searching for the suspect that had been captured on camera, and throughout all the media and all the online coverage of this event, it was, I don't know if you'd say it was interesting or disturbing to note, they never really wondered why. No one ever really questioned the motive, right? No one wondered why the CEO of a large insurance company who reportedly had the highest rate of denials among major insurers, no one wondered why he'd been targeted. In fact, there are plenty of spaces where it was celebrated, right? It was ultimately a McDonald's worker, I believe, who identified the current suspect, called him into the authorities, and people lashed out at that McDonald's. They responded by review bombing the McDonald's with negative reviews. There's even discussion now that the trial may fall apart because so many people sympathize with what happened. So many people are for it. And I mean, I do get it, I think, right? Like, I think I understand where people are coming from. I don't have a personal experience of a painful healthcare denial, but I can imagine how someone in a medical crisis would turn to their insurance provider who they'd been paying, expecting help. And I can imagine how helpless someone might feel, how they could feel betrayed and desperate, how their anger could burn when they were denied that help. You know, we live in a time when the injustices and cruelty that humanity is capable of are on full display. All across the world, there are people growing rich off the hopes and dreams of those who have less. Greed seems to be a value that in so many circles is blessed and coveted. And the most natural thing in the world is to see the unfairness, the injustice of it all, and to lash out, to take vengeance. Let them see what it's like to be on the other side. But as followers of Jesus, we're called to something different, to trust God, to do good, to dwell in the land, and befriend faithfulness. Monday was a day when our nation celebrated the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Lexington has a celebration downtown each year. There's a march and songs and speakers. Some of us from Southside were able to go that day. It was great. It was a great opportunity both to appreciate the hard work that was done in the past to fight segregation and racism. And it was a challenging reminder, too, of what work still waits to be done. You know, the civil rights movement was rooted deeply in a trust in God, a belief that violence was not required, but that faithfulness, that prayer, that the word of God and the work of the Holy Spirit alongside the courage to act and point out unfairness was capable, was enough to make a difference. Famously, Dr. King said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." Where does that thought come from? He, a minister, he sounds a lot like Paul. In Romans 12, he sounds like David in Psalm 37, to trust God, to do good, to dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Dr. King, the many others who joined him, are a great example of what Psalm 37 talks about, how we should respond to greed, to wickedness, to evil, to the unfairness from those around us. Instead of abandoning virtue, we lean deeper into the selfless, sacrificial love that Jesus modeled for us. We prioritize our closeness to Christ over our perceived results. And we trust that God is good and just. I'm really thankful. I'm thankful that David is the one who wrote Psalm 37. I don't know that anyone else could have written it with the perspective that David had. Because you see, David has been there. After David had been chosen to be the next king by God, the current ruler, Saul, pursued him, intent to murder him unfairly. Unjustly, David was hunted. He was hunted. And twice during that time, David finds himself in a position to kill Saul. Saul is defenseless, and David can put an end to his unfair treatment. This man is trying to kill him, and David can assume his rightful place on the throne. And he doesn't. He doesn't. He leaves it in God's hands, trusting God to see David through it. So when David urges us to respond to evil by trusting God, by remaining faithful, he knows what he's talking about. He knows that God does come through. But David also knows the other side. Later in life, David was the king. He was the man with all the power and the influence. And he saw something, he saw someone he wanted, a woman married to another man. So he took her, and he killed the man. David has also been the wicked man. And so when he says that wickedness brings about its own punishment, its own cost, he also knows firsthand what he's talking about. So I'd like us to close with his final words in Psalm 37. The salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their stronghold in the time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. At the end of the day, this whole discussion, it all really kind of comes down to this. Is this true? Like, can you really count on God to save you? Because if you can't count on God, then yeah, you kind of have to take it into your own hands. Repay evil with evil. But if this is true, right? If we can count on God to deliver us, then you can leave vengeance and punishment in God's hands, and you can do good. You can befriend faithfulness. And if you're not sure, if somewhere deep down your heart, you're just not sure, can I really trust him? I urge you to look to Jesus. Read about his life, his teaching. See how God became man, and through selfless, sacrificial love, he suffered and died to save you and me. He died to save you and me from our own wickedness, from our unfair, unjust, and evil deeds. We look to the cross. We look to the empty tomb and to our risen Savior. And we can know with confidence salvation is from the Lord. In a world full of unfair and wicked acts, we can be confident our God will deliver us. Let's stand together and let's worship him.
When my way grows